Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Reed Lance Rosenthal on the right side. KGAB AM 650 on your dial. Cheyenne, Wyoming, and the Town Square Network serving the Intermountain West, and KFEZ Colorado Springs, La Junta, Pueblo, and Denver, Southern Colorado, and webtalkradio.net. Howdy, folks. Welcome back this Saturday. We have a special treat for you today. We are talking, in fact, to Mitchell Barak in Jerusalem, Israel, the capital of Israel, even though the Democratic Party is rather loath to admit it. And Mitchell has a rather illustrious resume. He's the founder of Kevoon, that's K-E-E-V-O-O-N, Research, Strategy, and Communications. They are the leading polling firm over there in Israel. His surveys have been quoted in Time, Newsweek, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, MSNBC, which is amazing, CNN, you name it, even Al Jazeera, which is, that's praise from Caesar. And in addition, Mitchell has worked in some very interesting positions. He was a media advisor for President Shimon Peres. He was a speechwriter for Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. And he was also an aide to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a name that you have all heard. And I think he's going to bring a very interesting perspective. And he's going to talk a little bit about a film that he's involved in, which is just coming out. I've seen the trailer, which is terrific. We're going to give you the website called Absolutely Uncertain. And it's about what has happened to the relationships between Israel and the United States over the 4 years that Barack Obama has been our illustrious, not president. So, welcome to the show, Mitchell.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, my
pleasure. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Let me start off by saying, what in your opinion, and this is a unique viewpoint. I mean, you're a New York native, but you've been living in Israel for some time. You're a resident with your family of Jerusalem. You know, what is the attitude over in Israel? In Israel right now, relative to the United States and relative to the administration, and how is it different from the past 50 years?
Well, look, the Israelis always are very excited when there's an election in the United States, and Israelis in no way want to be involved in that election. Traditionally, Israel has received support from every president, whether Democratic or Republican, and it's received enthusiastic support throughout the years from the Congress and the Senate. So from the point of view of Israel, it's important that every 4 years these issues are discussed. But what's concerning Israelis right now most, I think, is the Iranian nuclear issue. Israelis view that issue as an existential threat to the state of Israel because we just have to take the Iranian president at his word. And he says he wants to have a nuclear bomb, and he also says that Israel has no right to exist. And the Zionist entity in Israel will cease to exist. So we have to take him for his word. We have to take his threats seriously. And we know from intelligence and from what the Iranians say that they are working fervently to produce a nuclear weapon, a nuclear warhead. And that's concern to Israelis. So Israelis see that as the main issue right now in the Middle East. The Arab Spring is also an issue. The fact that, about 2 years ago we thought that we would really have democracies and human rights in the region. We haven't seen any of that, and that's unfortunate. Israelis are also very concerned with the humanitarian crisis that's going on our border with Syria. Right now, thousands and thousands of innocent Syrian civilians have been killed, and many, many thousands more injured by the Assad regime. But yet the Obama administration does nothing about it, and the world community does nothing about it. And it has the chance that it will spill over into Israel, like it's doing into Turkey right now. But there's a humanitarian issue that's concerning Israelis. But if I had to sum it up, I would say the Iranian issue is the number one issue for Israelis right now. And I'm not convinced that people here feel that the U.S. administration has done enough to stop the Iranian nuclear program. Up until now, the administration has been pushing sanctions. Those sanctions have about as many holes as a piece of Swiss cheese, meaning, you know, there's sanctions against Iran, but 11 countries don't have to comply. China doesn't have to, and the Soviet Union, and Russia doesn't have to.
Yeah, let me jump in for just a moment. So you listeners know, by the way, I'm sorry, we have a little fuzzy on this connection, but we're talking over a span of about 8,000 miles here, so turn up the radio a little bit and listen carefully, because it's not often you get to hear from Jerusalem, Israel. Basically, you know, Barack Obama has been feeding us this nonsense about these sanctions for 3 years. You can see with your own eyes on television, even from the sparse coverage that some of the media centers give you, that it's not working. What you don't know is that there are 11 countries that he has exempted from those sanctions. As you do know, Russia and China have flatly said they're not going to go along with it, along with the rest of the BRIC countries, which includes South Africa. So the bottom line is, you don't have effective sanctions whatsoever. The Swiss cheese analogy used by Mitchell is very apt. And in my opinion, I think if the sanctions were full force and every country in the world was participating, I don't think it would dissuade the Iranian regime, who is ideological and driven by several things, but one of them is a hatred of Israel. I don't think it would stop them whatsoever. So just as a little background, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mitchell.
Yeah, no, I think that's very correct. I think that, you know, the one thing that I forgot to mention is that Iran is a world sponsor of terror. I mean, they're a regional sponsor, certainly in the Middle East. Hezbollah in Lebanon receives both funding, training, and instructions from Tehran, as does the Hamas in Gaza.
Yes, and Americans can remember just earlier this summer, the Iranians tried to knock off the Israeli ambassador right there in Washington, D.C. So, you know, it extends to the United States.
Right, and Al-Qaeda, too. They're in there with Al-Qaeda. And it's a problem. Look, the fact that so many countries are exempt, the fact that companies are exempt, the oil prices are affecting people. You know, you have to cut down on usage of certain products. It's not going well, meaning, look, Israelis see an existential threat in the Iranian nuclear program. So let me just put you in the minds of Israelis for a second. When President Obama says we're going to impose sanctions, rigorous sanctions, with certain exceptions, on Iran, Israelis are hearing we have the ability to stop Nazi Germany, but we're not doing it serious enough, meaning we need to bomb the tracks leading to Auschwitz, but not today. Maybe in the spring. Maybe after the election. Meaning that's how Israelis view it. I'm not saying that that's how it is, but that's how Israelis view it, because Israelis see it as an existential threat. The second that Ahmadinejad and the Iranians get a nuclear bomb, Israel's existence is at stake, as is the region. Meaning I don't think that the Gulf states are less threatened by it, and I think they're nervous as well.
Listen, I think America, the territorial boundaries of America are threatened. You can't tell me with the American borders being the sieve that they are under the current administration, quite intentionally, that somebody couldn't smuggle a small nuclear device, which the Iranians would be all too happy to give them, into a major city or a port in the United States. And I think the same dialogue that we hear in Iran when they spew vitriol toward Israel and threaten it with extinction, not threaten it, I mean promise it with extinction, is the same vitriol you hear toward the big Satan, which is us, America. So it's our ass on the line along with yours.
Yeah, no, I agree with that assessment 100%. I agree with that assessment. And I think the one successful, I have to say that Israelis in general, like very much President George Bush. And one of the reasons they liked him was because he understood the threat of terror, and he understood how to stop terror. And, you know, there are some that were supported the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. There are some that opposed to it. But I think a lot of Americans take for granted the fact that you can walk into a Starbucks or into a mall, into a shopping mall, or into a Walmart or a Costco, and nobody opens your bags and checks for a bomb. And, you know, every Starbucks and Baskin and Robbins doesn't have a security guard standing outside to make sure that no one is coming in as a suicide bomber.
But in Israel, they do.
Correct. Imagine what your business would look like if your chain had to have a security guard 24/7 whenever you are open. And every coffee shop has to have one in Israel, and every restaurant has to have one. And the fact that the United States, starting with George Bush, continuing with Barack Obama, was able to take that terrorism and keep it in the region, out of the United States, is really a great victory for the American people and something that you don't see every day.
Well, actually, terrorism has come to the United States because we had 43 soldiers wounded and 13 killed by an Arab terrorist at Fort Hood. But, of course, our administration termed that workplace violence. They're kind of the same hood that they try and pull over everybody's eyes with their recent cover-up on the Libya terrorism, where we lost an ambassador and three other Americans. I mean, it took them 2 weeks to admit what they knew the day after.
Right.
Out of curiosity, what did Israelis think of that that whole fiasco?
Well, look, Israelis are concerned because Israelis know that every Israeli embassy and consulate abroad is a target, and every Israeli working abroad is a target, and every Israeli tourist is a target. I mean, Israelis get warnings before every holiday season that if they're going to travel to India or if they're going to travel to Thailand or if they're going to travel to Sinai, they really have to be careful because there are terrorists that are targeting hotels that have Israelis, and we've had that. In Mumbai, we had that. We've had that in Sinai. We've had it in other places. But that it shows a certain desperation on the part of the terror organizations and the terror networks that they can't bring their terror and their war onto our home front and the United States home front, that they have to bring it into a different arena, into an arena that they're more comfortable and that they have an advantage and it's harder to protect. But, again, the people at home are safer.
Right. Just out of curiosity, how do Israelis view, and how do you view, the stance of the Obama administration toward Israel versus the stance of previous administrations?
Well, look, I mean, I think that President Obama, and certainly he's done things that are unprecedented and that are positive, including the Iron Dome, which is a missile defense system which the U.S. paid for and deploys. Which protects Israeli citizens, unfortunately, on a daily basis in southern towns like Ashdod and Ashkelon and Be'er Sheva from missile and rocket attacks that are coming in from Gaza. And it's successful. It's an amazing system that can successfully predict the trajectory of a missile to see if it's actually going to hit a population center. If it's not going to hit a population center, it doesn't do anything. If it is going to hit a population center, it fires a rocket or a missile that's going to stop it, and I think that's an amazing thing that's been done. I think that there's a lot of the general atmosphere has not been a good one with the U.S. administration, and that's partially a clash of personalities between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama, but it certainly didn't help the cold reception he's received at some point in Washington at the White House. I mean, there were some unprecedented things that took place at a meeting between the president and the prime minister, which had never happened before. And so there's a general atmosphere also of pressure that the U.S. administration is putting on the Israelis, including right away after, you know, while campaigning and within, you know, while campaigning, Jerusalem is, you know, besides the fact that everyone agrees during the campaign season that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, right after the Obama administration said there should be no building in neighborhoods in Jerusalem. Well,
right.
No Israelis believe that, even the left of center ones. Jerusalem is Jerusalem, and we're going to build everywhere that we want in Jerusalem.
And conveniently, Jerusalem as the capital of Israel was left out of the Democratic platform. In fact, I'm sure they were played in Israel. If you listen to the voice vote there, which had to be taken three times, the nays carried,
right.
Not the ayes.
Right, right. I know. It was a kind of sort of convenient democracy. But the other thing that happened that took place is the Obama administration put pressure on the Netanyahu administration to freeze the settlements for 9 months in order to create an atmosphere where the Palestinians would come to the negotiating table. Well, Prime Minister Netanyahu was the first prime minister that actually put a freeze on settlements. His left-wing predecessors did not do that. So he did that. He lost a lot of internal capital among his own electorate, among the Likud electorate. But what did he get at the end of the day? Meaning Abu Mazen and the Palestinians never came to the table. And there was just more pressure by the U.S. to continue the settlement freeze and some of the condemnation.
Let me interject that those settlements that's really a misnomer. I mean, those were planned housing developments in the capital of your country that were approved in an agreement with Bill Clinton in 1998 and 1999. This wasn't some new settlement deal that you just conjured up.
Correct, correct. The ones in Jerusalem are certainly not up for debate. And even the settlements that are in, you know, what's termed as the West Bank and Gaza, what some Israelis call Judea and Samaria, many of those settlements were started in the time of Yitzhak Rabin. And certainly, you know, there's a 5% natural growth rate within the settlements of people having children. So you have to expand some of those settlements. I mean, it got to the point in some of those settlements that if a family wanted to add a bedroom, turn their terrace into a bedroom, they couldn't do it. Because, you know, there's a settlement freeze. I think what was really problematic is Israelis have come to know and expect the State Department and the State Department's position, both about the settlements and about Jerusalem. And when the State Department spokesman gets up there and says, you know, Jerusalem will be negotiated with any, you know, final status and so forth, Israelis expect that. But when the White House spokesman gets up and says that, he doesn't even say that. He just says, I can't tell you what the capital of Israel is. You know our position.
Yeah. Carney, Rice, of course, Rice has her own problems after her Sunday circuit with the Libya terrorist attack. But, you know, I mean, all the way down, up and down the line in this administration, there is a definite lack of support for an undivided Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, period.
Right. Right, and Israelis feel that, and it's not a good feeling. And under the Israelis, the ability to live together here in Jerusalem has only flourished. And it's not just a matter of jobs and education and health care available to both sets of the population, but it's also access to holy sites. I mean, you know, when the Arabs controlled Jerusalem, the Jews were not allowed for many hundreds of years to pray at their holiest sites. And when Israel has control of those...
And nor were Christians.
Correct, correct, correct. Well, what's going on with Christians in Bethlehem, I mean, the Christian community is being chased out of there by the Muslim community. I mean, there's a real persecution going on that is really problematic and is changing the makeup of both Bethlehem and Nazareth, meaning they're being persecuted because they're not Muslim. I mean, the Muslims have an agenda. If you're not with us, you're against us. There's no room for diversity there. And a lot of Christians are feeling that, and that's something that during, you know, as long as Israel is in charge and Israel is responsible, there will be free access to all religions, and there will be respect for all religions and people that need to pray.
And what was the reaction in Israel when our illustrious president said that, gee, you ought to think about returning to your 1967 borders?
Look, Israelis, for the most part, Israelis don't agree with it. Anyone who thinks it's possible to go back, no one really agrees with that. Everyone thinks there has to be some kind of change, some kind of give, meaning if we're going to take the 67 borders, then we have to give up somewhere else. Meaning there's already 150,000 to 250,000 people living in communities in Judea and Samaria. You can't just say, you have to evacuate those communities. And what is really racist here, and really wouldn't go on anywhere else in the world, is similar to what happened in Gaza, meaning Israel says, okay, you Palestinian Authority, we're going to give you control of this area. The Palestinians say, okay, we want a state, but we don't want any Jews in our state. You have a community, you've lived here 30 years, 40 years, however many years you've lived here, but you have to vacate those communities. Does that happen anywhere else in the world? Is there anywhere else in the world where you can discriminate on the basis of race or gender or religion? I mean, does that sound when the Palestinians go to the United Nations and say they're ready for statehood? No one in the United Nations can wake up and say, wait a second here, let's talk about statehood, but how could you have a state with no Jews? I mean, Israel's a country with 7 million people, of which 1 million of them are Israeli Arabs. They're not Jewish. But yet, they have full voting rights, they can be elected to parliament, and about 10 or 12 members of Knesset are Israeli Arabs, many of whom support the very terror organizations which are trying to destroy the state. So they can be elected to parliament, they can hold any job, they can even be elected prime minister. That's the kind of society that Israel has created. Now you want to tell me that the Palestinians are ready for statehood, a Jew-free state. I find that very offensive as a human being, not just as a Jew. And I think that other people should speak up against that.
Well, I think we both have to recognize, as does everybody else, that despite the support without which the United Nations would collapse of the United States, the number one and number two boogeymen on the UN hit list is the United States and Israel. I mean,
right.
We stand for everything that the globalists don't like. That's a perfect kind of segue. So you look at what Obama is doing. You look at his quote-unquote reach-out, reset, whatever you want to call it, with the quote-unquote Muslim world. You look at his pulling that 67 border stuff out of his butt during that speech. You look at the administration. You look at the Democratic platform debacle. You look at all this, and then you look at his, I can only call it coddling, of anything Muslim. And is the impression over there in Israel, and your impression too, if it differs from most of the country, do you think this is intentional? Do you think it's naive? Do you think he's a Muslim sympathizer? Do you think that he harbors some, as some of the guests I've had on the show, Dinesh D'Souza, believe that he dislikes America and dislikes Israel because we are the big and little colonial powers? I mean, what would you attribute it to?
Well, look, I do think the interesting thing, when you say America is a colonial power, it's very interesting, because when I worked for President Shimon Peres as his spokesman, one of the more amazing things that he said was, America is the greatest country in the world, and it's probably the greatest empire that ever existed in mankind, because it has acquired things, or it curries favor by giving and not by taking. You know, every other country from the Roman Empire till today the Soviet Union, you have to conquer land in order to be bigger. In the United States, there's no conquering. It's giving money, it's giving foreign aid, it's helping out other people. And even when the United States goes in to attack another country, they have no interest in staying there or in taking any of the resources. They're interested in giving it back to the people that live there. So, I find it hard to, when people call America a colonial entity, because I really believe, like President Peres, that America is great because it gives and not because it takes.
You and I agree 100%, and Dinesh D'Souza agrees with us. My question is, what do you think is really going on with Barack Obama and his minions? I mean, what is prompting this this situation with your country?
Well, I think he doesn't you had asked before about the Arabs and extending his hand to the Arabs like he did in Cairo. He came to Cairo, for example, and he basically extended his hands to the Arab world at a time that they weren't particularly interested in it. But the way the Middle East works, you have to show strength. When you show openness, and you're showing weakness, and nobody respects weakness in the Middle East. And Israel didn't get to be where it was because everyone thinks Israel is a nice country. It's because Israel has a great military power, the Israel Defense Forces, and one of the only countries in the world whose army has the name defense in it. And Israel has the Mossad, which every Arab in the world believes is in every Arab country, and probably is, and has the ability to know things like no other security agency. It's because
the Mossad, folks, is like our CIA times 10.
I wouldn't want to put down the CIA, but the Mossad is very, very effective, especially with Arabic-speaking countries because we have so many Arabic speakers. But the point is that you have to show strength in the Middle East, and I'm not convinced that Barack Obama, as president, showed that he had strength, that America was strong. It represented an apologetic America, and I think that was a mistake with regard to the Arab countries. I think he also missed the vote when it came to the Arab Spring, meaning the Arab Spring was a real opportunity to really try and put some democratic roots down and really try and influence things. And just look at the situation in Iran. I mean, if the U.S. is not funding the rebels in Iran and Syria actively and providing everything from weapons to communications equipment and so forth, there's something wrong going on there.
Well, not only that, he left the Iranian demonstrators with that regime teetering. He left them on the lurch in 2009. I mean, they were asking for his help, and he ignored them.
Right. So, you know, I think when it comes to foreign policy, I think Israelis see that and see that there's a certain weakness. At the same time, you know, I mean, it's kind of President Obama got the Nobel Peace Prize when he barely even took office for really not doing anything. So, you know, it's nice to get a Nobel Peace Prize, but, you know, what does he have to show for it? He certainly didn't have anything before he got the prize. They gave it to him kind of like on credit that he was actually going to create peace in the world, but he hasn't. You know, and what started out in, again, this is in the Israeli view, when if we go back to the 2008 election, Israel was probably the only country in the world where when we polled the population, and I did poll them a number of times, there was much more support for John McCain than there was for Barack Obama. And there were two things that stick out in Israeli minds for John McCain. One is his military experience. He was a prisoner of war, a hero, and so forth, and that's important to Israelis, that he understands military, he understands terror. And the other is his age. Israel is a country that actually likes older politicians because gray hair and age means experience. It means life experience. It means wisdom. It means people that think a little bit. So Israelis liked McCain going into the election. As soon as Obama was elected, Israelis, like the rest of America and the rest of the world, were swept into this hope and change and new world order that President Obama was trying to create. But now we're, you know, 4 years into that, and there's not a lot of great change. And the economy in the U.S. isn't that much better. But particularly with regard to, you know, Israel and the region, we don't have the Middle East peace. We have a region that's much less stable. You have countries around us which are crumbling. And
you mean much, much more unstable than when you took
yes,
off.
Yes, correct.
Yes.
Correct. Much more unstable. If I said it, I apologize. So it's a more unstable. I mean, look at Egypt. Meaning, as much as, Mubarak may not have been a champion of human rights, we had stability on the border. And there was some law and order in Egypt. Today, we have the Muslim Brotherhood. So the very weapons that the United States taxpayer, that many of your listeners have been paying $1.5 billion a year for the past number of years to arm the Egyptian army, the Muslim Brotherhood has those. And they're a terrorist organization, or they're a sympathetic, a political party that's sympathetic, or a sister a political party to a terrorist organization.
Yeah, who are industriously building their ties with Iran.
Correct. Building up their ties with Iran and moving troops into the Sinai, probably against the agreement, the peace treaty with Israel in 79, excuse me. So you have a lot of problems, and where's the U.S. in this whole thing? Where's the U.S. in Syria? Where's the humanitarian aid? Where's the world or world trying to stop? It's just a massacre of Syrian civilians, and we don't see it happening. And, you know, Tunisia also in the region, not necessarily more stable. And, you know, people are wondering whether Jordan is next, what's next in the region. And there doesn't seem, again, when it comes to these countries, strength is what talks. And
exactly.
We're not convinced the United States has shown that here in the region.
So give us a little, I want to come back to this point, but, you know, this is a rare opportunity for my listeners to talk to somebody in Israel, okay, particularly with somebody with your background and knowledge. Give us a snapshot of the life of an Israeli. I mean, most people don't know that military service is mandatory, gun training is mandatory. Tell us a little bit about that. What it's like to live in a surrounded state.
Well, we've kind of adapted to it. So, first of all, I would encourage everyone who's listening to visit Israel. There's a lot to do here. It's a great place to be. There's a lot of fun things. There's a lot of religious things. There's a lot of historical archaeology. It's a great place to take a vacation. And from the Colorado area, it's only probably about a 10 or 11-hour flight.
And a beautiful coastline.
And a beautiful coastline. We have a beach. We have great scuba diving in Eilat. Tel Aviv is on the coast. Haifa is on the coast. Caesarea. You have really historical, both, to the Jewish religion and to Christians, Bethlehem and Nazareth, and many, many places that are holy to the three major religions, including Islam as well, of course. So I would encourage everyone to come here. But we always do live in the shadow of having to defend ourselves. We live in a neighborhood that it's very, very difficult. I mean, imagine if you are, and you're in Colorado. Imagine if you could not leave Colorado by car. The only way for you to leave Colorado would be to get on a plane or a boat. So that's how we feel in Israel. We can't really go to Jordan, although lately you've been able to drive a car into Jordan, but very few Israelis do it because you have to change your license plates so that you're not attacked. You can't go into Egypt by car. You can now cross the border, but basically you have to fly to Europe, to the United States, if you want a vacation, if you want to leave the country. So Israelis feel a little bit landlocked. Number one, it's a very modern society. We have a modern train system, a bus system, roads, and so forth. The high tech here is as good as anywhere in the world. Many of the great startups are in Israel or have started in Israel. We've had a lot of companies that have research and development here in Israel, Intel, Google, Microsoft, IBM, all have research and development facilities. And some of those major companies, and I'm forgetting many of them, but many of those companies, either they have only in Israel a research and development center, or they have in Israel and maybe one or two other locations, meaning it's seen as a place where there are very, very smart people, there are very successful people. We had a number of Nobel Prize winners in chemistry and, of course, a Nobel Peace Prize. And there's just a lot of going on. It's a very dynamic business environment. Israelis are also involved in business in other countries in Europe, specifically in Eastern Europe. But we always are, growing up in the shadow of terror and of threat. Every Israeli goes into the army. I have four sons who will be entering the army in 8 years from now, in 10 years from now, in 12 years from now, and in 16 years from now. I mean, and that's on the kids' minds. I have a 10-year-old who's already talking about what he might want to do in the army. Just like in the United States, someone who's in, let's say, junior high school or high school is thinking about where he wants to go to college. Well, in Israel, Israelis are thinking, Jewish Israelis, that is, because the Arabs don't serve in the army.
And that's true for the gals, too, right? I mean, it's mandatory for everyone.
Yeah, girls, women serve in the army as well, and they're thinking, what unit do they want to go into? What type of service do they want? It's anywhere from 2.5 to 3 years. It's a big commitment, and then they have to start university after that. So they're already 21 or 22, 23 when they start university. At the same time, I mentioned that every coffee shop you go into, they check your bag. If you go to the bus station, you have to put your bag through a metal detector as if you were going to an airport. We've gotten used to it. If someone leaves a bag in the middle of the street, they'll close down the whole street, and they'll check what's in the bag. And, we've become accustomed to that. We've paid the price of living and defending ourselves in our homeland, in our But I would say, in a nutshell, Israel is a very modern country. We have a number of universities, about 6 or 7 universities here, plus colleges and other technical schools. It's at a very high level, engineering, physics, chemistry, medicine, medical schools, all of these things. It's really a first-world country. Israelis see themselves probably culturally closest to the United States as opposed to Europe, meaning much closer to the United States rather than any other country. A lot of Israelis speak English, and it's just it's a great place to be. There's a very good dynamic here, a very good vibe, and we've learned to, you know, deal with what we have. At the same time, I can tell you, I already have my gas masks for my family. We keep them in a special room in our apartment, which is a 4-bedroom apartment. One of those bedrooms is a reinforced concrete, has double the amount of concrete in that room, so that it's supposed to withstand a rocket attack, a direct hit. Every new building that's built in Israel must have what's called a safe room, which is both reinforced concrete and can be sealed against a gas attack. And it's something that we think about. It's something that doesn't get us down and depressed. And it's just how it is. And we go on, and it's a great place to be. And for those of you that have been to Israel that are listening, you'll know what I'm talking about. You wouldn't know it. If you don't read the newspapers that talk about, the conflict, you wouldn't realize that this is a country that has a lot of conflict.
That's been a great, and I think very insightful for many of these listeners. I mean, putting it in the perspective of not being able to leave Colorado or Wyoming or Nebraska, you know, worrying about a missile falling on your head at any time, having building codes which, mandate safe rooms that are safe from attack and from gas. I mean, this is just kind of beyond comprehension for Americans. But it's something that they need to comprehend, and it's something they need to understand about, really, our number one ally in the world, next to Britain. And I'm going to ask you one more question. What is the sentiment on the street about Israel launching a first strike against Iran?
Well, that's a complicated question. If I had the answer to that, I don't know.
What's your gut level?
Look, Israelis believe that Israel has a right to defend itself anywhere and everywhere in the world, no matter what. We took out the Iraqi nuclear reactor in 1981. We took out, apparently, the Syrian nuclear reactor, which no one even knew existed, about 2-3 years ago. If we have to do it, we'll do it. The problem is that there may be a very big diplomatic price to be paid. And this is what the Iranians have done. They say, you attack us, we'll unleash the Hezbollah and Hamas against you. So, it would more likely drag Israel into a war, into a regional war. I think that Israelis, the man on the street, is hopeful that the U.S. will take the lead with this, and that the U.S. will either lead an attack or be involved with Israel or give its blessing to Israel to go ahead and do this for the good of the world. Because, as you so correctly said in the beginning of the program, it's only a matter of time before a nuclear bomb or a nuclear device can be put in a briefcase and, flown into, Los Angeles Airport or over the border from Mexico. And the world has really changed. And military warfare has changed with the advent of terrorism. You can now take the conflict to your enemy's home turf, and you don't need a large army, and you don't necessarily need massive funding. And
you need one small container and a guy who's willing to die.
Right.
That's all you need.
Right. I mean, look at the Twin Towers, which was a terrible terrorist attack. There was not a big budget for that. And they were able to commandeer, everyday airplanes and use it against the United States. And imagine if, those kinds of people, especially, we have people that are willing to, it's not just that when you go into an army, you're willing to die. But now we're dealing with people that want to die, that expect to die. So it's just a question of when. So there are enough volunteers to carry a nuclear bomb.
And whose targets are not other soldiers.
Right. And the targets are civilians. And, you want to keep that as far away from the region. And once they attain the nuclear capability, they passed the point of no return, and the object is to, you know, to stop it.
Yeah, well, Iran getting a nuclear bomb is not just a regional changer; it's a world changer. But just how confident are you? How confident are the Israeli people that under President Barack Obama, America will step up to the plate with Israel if you have to, if you have to go?
It's hard to say, and especially timing here is important because we're now coming up to an election. So it will be interesting to see what happens in the election. And then after the election, it could be a period of a lame duck President Obama. It could be a period where he's going to be reelected and take office again. I don't know. I mean, I can't say, but I can say that up until now, Israelis don't particularly feel that the Iranian issue is being handled correctly by the United States.
So would it be accurate to say that most Israelis don't feel that Barack Obama has the warm fuzzies for Israel?
Well, I think that's the general tone from the White House. I don't think you need Israelis to to tell you that. But I think that there has been somewhat of a change in language and tone of voice with the U.S. administration, and then on top of it, the personality clashes between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu has not been great, for the relationship. Fortunately, we have a very, very strong relationship with the Congress and Senate, and that's really where the Israeli people are going to put their hopes and their efforts with Congress and with the Senate, and again, the Senate is now going to try and increase the sanctions, meaning if there's any hope of salvation, that's where it's going to come from. And there is a support across the board on both sides of the aisle within the Senate and Congress. It's just, a question of what tone of voice is coming from the White House, and is that going to be something that's going to tolerate a nuclear Iran, or not going to be against it, or is it something that has to be stopped at all costs? And I think people have to see it. In the Israeli eyes, a nuclear Iran must be stopped at all costs. I mean, if it used to be that 70 years ago, and here again, I'm speaking in the eyes of Israelis and how Israelis see it. If 70 years ago you had to bring the Jews to Auschwitz and Treblinka in order to complete the final solution, today you can bring the final solution in a nuclear bomb to the Jewish state.
Yeah, and there is no such thing as containment in an age where missiles can cover 5,000 miles in 7 minutes.
Right, and that is very scary, too.
And that is true for the United States, just as it is true for Israel. And with Russian and Chinese technology aiding Iran, it's only a question of time, should they get the bomb, that they will have missiles capable of delivering payloads to the United States. I mean, people need to wake up. And if not, they'll put missiles in Venezuela with their good buddy Chavez.
That's right, and if you've noticed, meaning the reason that Russia and China are not involved in the sanctions is because Iran is big business for them. And just don't put it past them that one day, for the right price, maybe one of those countries will sell them a nuclear bomb. And if you don't stop that now, that's where we're headed, and that's a real problem.
All right. Well, listen, this has been hugely insightful. We didn't talk about, and I want to spend the last minute or two talking about this film, which is absolutely uncertain. I've seen the trailer, folks. You really got to see it. It's very well done. It has all sorts of folks and quotes and real life people in their own words about what's going on with Israel, Iran, the Middle East, etc. It's absolutelyuncertain.com. And why don't you take just a moment, Mitchell, and tell us just a little bit about that.
All right, well, I was interviewed by the film, for the film, because of my expertise in Israeli public opinion. So I was not involved in making it or producing it. But what I think it tries to do, the film, is kind of put some perspective on the relationship between President Obama and the State of Israel. And it's absolutely uncertain. It's correct, You're not 100% sure, does he have Israel's back or doesn't he have Israel's back? Meaning, on the one hand, it's the voice of Barack Obama, but it's the hands of someone else. And, I think it's eye-opening in that, it brings that up. It interviews some well-known some well-known media figures in Israel.
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, some of the interviews are Elliot Engel, who's a Democrat from New York, Bob Menendez, who's a Democrat from New Jersey, Joseph Lieberman, independent Connecticut, New York City Mayor Ed Koch, Harvard professor Alan Dershowitz, all sorts of mainstream news reports. I mean, it's very well documented, and it's kind of narrated. I found it very, just great, by a gal by the name of Irina, and she's a 23-year-old liberal. I mean, she's definitely liberal. A Jewish New Yorker voted for Obama in 2008, and why his stance relative to Israel and the Mideast has changed her vote in 2012. But it is documented. This is not a bunch of pundit stuff. This is real-life things, folks, and you need to see it. AbsolutelyUncertain.com. It's been viewed by over 2 million people so far.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, Mitchell, thanks very much for the time today. It was absolutely a treat and an honor. You stay safe and well over there.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk, and I look forward to speaking to you again. And thank you.
And hopefully we will get our caca together over here. And after November 6th, you guys can breathe at least a slight sigh of relief. We shall see.
That's for you to determine, not for us.
I understand. Thanks very, very much
okay.
for your time.
Okay, thank you. Take care.
Bye now.
Bye.
Folks, that was an insightful interview. It's not often you get to talk directly to a country 8,000 miles away that's as beleaguered as our number one ally in the world. So hopefully that gave you a perspective that you've not heard before. I'm sorry for the scratchy nature of the connection. It's the best we could do. But hope you hung in there. And this is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the right side, broadcasting to you from KGAB AM 650 and the Town Square Network, serving the Intermountain West, and KFEZ, Colorado Springs, La Junta Pueblo, and South Denver, Southern Colorado, and webtalkradio.net. And I'm going to check real quick and see if we have time for a final segment. And actually, we really don't. I was going to talk to you a little bit about this latest jobs report, the 7.8%. This was after 1.7 million illegal aliens were given an amnesty and allowed to go to work, and more than half of them already have work cards. So we've increased the workforce by 800,000 to a million since June 15th. And we had 114,000 jobs in September, and the rate went down to 7.8%. Let me think about this for a moment. CU, which is the real rate of unemployment, that's the underemployed, et cetera, was 14.7% prior to this report. It's still at 14.7%. So now how does one index go down when the other index, of which the first index is a part, doesn't change? I'll let you answer that. Could it be politics? You mean kind of like covering up the Libyan terrorist attack for 2 weeks when they knew, in the face of insurmountable evidence, despite their own national security team testifying before Congress that it was terror? And now we're finding out that they were asked for extra security before, and in fact they decreased it. Gee, they didn't know this? They didn't know this when they were talking to us, when Ambassador Rice and the President and Hillary Clinton and the rest of the clowns, like Carney, were telling us how this was all about a video and how there was no problem over there and Al-Qaeda is vanquished because Osama bin Laden is dead. My personal theory is that the crowing and the foot stomping and the ball spiking about Osama bin Laden is one of the things that kind of incited all that over there. I mean, I believe that Barack Obama's videos spiking the football over the bin Laden death is one of the things that got people riled up. Look at the film clips. People saying that we are Osama, right? People carrying the pictures of bin Laden. I mean, what do you think got them riled up? Anyway, we don't have time to go into that in detail today. We're going to on another show. Next week, we have a terrific show with Herb London. one of the foremost experts in voter fraud in the United States, and he's going to have some tips. Well, what's going on, number one, with voter fraud? Number two, what you can do about it in your own community. And it's very apropos with the key election in the last 100 years coming our way. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next week.
For more information about Reed and his work, please go to webtalkradio.net and look for Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side. There, you can also click to purchase the first two volumes of his number one best-selling historical Western series, Threads West, An American Saga, and Maps of Fate. And now, the first volume of his new nonfiction series, Land for Love and Money, is available everywhere. Or go to landforloveandmoney.com. That's Land for Love and Money. We'd also like to remind you that if you missed any shows, you can go to the show archives on Reed's Web Talk Radio.